Yeah, in one way, it's inspiring, and long term, it's a goal.
Yes.
But as you mentioned, like for instance, if I were to look up to America, and I think, well, the Constitution. Look how wonderful that document crafted. It seems to taking care of everything, and yet on the same token, you say, but it's going in the wrong avenue, attacking constantly. It's a giant war machine that, once the Soviet Union, a legitimate threat, you might say, has crumbled and gone bankrupt. How can you be spending so much on an arming and, you know, almost creating this war on terror, where I think personally it was a setup job, and just to continue this outlandish spending of the, you know, it's not even an arms race anymore because there's nobody to race against. It's just continually funding this Defense Department that needs bigger and more high power weaponry. When you think we should be finished with weapons, and especially you mentioned a few times nuclear weapons, but it seems that with black budgets, that you know they're. I shudder to think about how much Americans are really spending on the military. You know, that's going to bankrupt the country, as people have made analogies to the Roman Empire, that they ran out of places to conquer.
Well, that's true, but we can't become overwhelmed by all of this, the hugeness of it all. If one's own life can become a freeing of one's whole being from that kind of power, then anything becomes possible in the world. You know, it's a basic concept that the one piece of ground that can become free in my life is the piece of ground that I'm standing on. I can't free people all across the world so much as I can free myself. But I free myself so much as I not cooperate with the oppression that's hurting people in other parts of the world. It's the same deal. It's the same deal. It's Gandhi's basic concept. He wrote a little book called Hind Swaraj. And the basic vision of Hind Swaraj is that the means is the end in the process of becoming. A nonviolent means, if we choose a nonviolent means, we're choosing the nonviolent end at the same time. As we do it in our own lives, then we can join with other people in doing it in community and in international movements. But if you're afraid of losing your job, if you're afraid of going to jail, if you're afraid of saying no to your government, if you're afraid of going to another country and resisting nonviolent oppression in that country, if you're afraid in all of those respects, then you're part of the oppression, and the oppression is part of your own life, and it's oppressing you first of all, oppressing me first of all. But if I overcome that fear and am willing to go to jail, for example, for not paying taxes or for not cooperating with my government in regard to laws that uphold military power and our military power in other countries, if I'm not afraid of that, then I'm all of a sudden free. And if I'm willing to walk into jail as a result of walking in resistance to drone warfare or to nuclear weapons or to assassinations in Afghanistan, if I'm willing to resist all of that and as a result maybe lose my job, I can be free. I'm going to find other ways of living in the world than a job which requires my maintaining that kind of violent attitude. Liberate ourselves and we become free to work for a transformed world. That's Gandhi's whole concept. The means and the end are equivalent. It's the same thing.
You know, I guess everyone's hope is that we'll be successful.
Well, we will be successful. If we can be successful with this violent creature called myself, we can be successful anywhere.
And I'm not trying to be argumentative, but as you say that, I think of, for instance, Bradley Manning, who made a decision to, you know, he was in the military complex, and he said, I've witnessed the shootings in the streets from the Apache helicopters or whatever, and that, and I'm going to release this to people. They don't realize how bad it is. And now, you know, he's sitting in a jail cell, and if all of America does not get behind him, it's a similar situation to Gandhi, that people are arrested, just locked up, and, you know, you can have a peaceful civil disobedience. I mean, in his case, he'll be suffering a military court-martial, but it actually is going to take the attention of more people to get behind those ideas.
I agree. Unless we're willing to go to the degree that Bradley Manning was, apparently, to risk our future for the sake of justice and peace and the truth, this country and the world is not going to be free. But also recognize, however, that Bradley Manning is much freer than those of us outside prison who have not gone to that length. Bradley Manning is a much freer man than any of those members of his same unit are today, a far freer man.
And that discussion does continue for a little longer, but on that transcendent note, we shall leave it. We're switching over to a program from a couple of months ago. This is an interview by Sasha Lilly for KPFA's Against the Grain program. You can access their archives at againstthegrain.org. The discussion is with a scholar of direct action movements in the US in the 70s and 80s. And I hope this proves useful if you're in an Occupy or related to one, to prompting discussion about tactics or strategy and the role of violence or non-violence. I'm going to conclude with a few minutes of thought about what the internet and new organizing strategies, new organizing software could mean, because I'm quite excited about the Occupies as a constituency for an internet-based gift economy.
I'm Sasha Lilly. It was a leaderless movement based on consensus decision-making, radical egalitarianism, prefigurative politics, and a series of mass occupations that involved thousands of people. But it's not the obvious guess, the Occupy movement, but rather a set of movements in the late 1970s and 80s, many of them directed against nuclear power and nuclear weapons. While the names the Clamshell Alliance and Livermore Action Group are only known to some now, the politics of these movements left a deep imprint on subsequent forms of protest and struggle. For the second part of our look on the activist and political influences on the Occupy movement, I'm joined by Barbara Epstein. She's a scholar of social movements and chair of the History of Consciousness Department at UC Santa Cruz. Her classic book on this important precursor movement, Political Protest and Cultural Revolution, Nonviolent Direct Action in the 1970s and 80s, was published 20 years ago, but she's kindly agreed to come in and talk about the movements and what we can learn from them today. It's great to have you here.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So let's just start with a definition. When we talk about the nonviolent direct action movements of the 70s and 80s, what exactly are we talking about? What movements?
Well, the movements that I looked at were three movements within a larger terrain, essentially, of movements that were opposed to nuclear power and to the nuclear arms race, and that hoped that opposition on those issues would lead to a broader movement for a nonviolent egalitarian society. So the idea was that these specific struggles would lead to a revolutionary movement, but a revolutionary movement conceived in nonviolent terms.
And what were the characteristics of these movements? What sort of features did they tend to embody?
Well, each of them wound up focusing on the tactic of civil disobedience and the use of consensus. All of them were informed by a perspective that blended feminism, anarchism, environmentalism, and an overall insistence on egalitarianism and the building of egalitarian community. Nonviolence was not understood exactly as pacifism. There were people in the movement who were pacifists, but I would say for the majority of people in all of these movements, pacifism was not a commitment to never using violence. It was a preference. And it was a view that in the United States, nonviolence is a far preferable tactic than the use of violence for building mass movements. And, of course, it was also a vision of a future society, which would be, hopefully, as nonviolent as possible.
And people tended to organize themselves. I mean, you mentioned consensus politics, that's one part, but these movements also tended to organize themselves through a particular interesting structure, which was imported, let's just say, in the 1960s from the case of the Spanish anarchists of the 30s by Murray Bookchin, the anarchist writer and activist, around affinity groups. What are affinity groups? How did they work in these movements?
The way these affinity groups worked was that in each of these movements, at the center of the movement, were small groups of people that worked together on particular projects, often outside of the context of the movement, but that came together to form this movement and formed its decision-making structure. And so what that meant was that, in a way, the center of the movement was the civil disobedience actions, in which often hundreds or thousands of people would commit civil disobedience, be arrested, and then there would be a time spent in jail. And the way in which decisions were made, both leading up to that action and in jail, was that the affinity groups would get together. They would make decisions. They would have spokespeople. The spokespeople would form a spokes council, and every decision would be relayed back and forth between the spokes council and the affinity groups. And the idea was that everyone's voice should be included. Everyone should be involved in decisions. The form that is still used in the Occupy movement of voting for a proposal, standing aside, or blocking it was used in these actions. My impression, by the way, was that it either worked wonderfully or terribly. There was not very much in between.
So we'll talk more about the specifics of these movements themselves, most famously, at least nationally, the Clamshell Alliance here in the Bay Area, the Abalone Alliance, the Livermore Action Group, many listeners, in fact, probably involved in some of the West Coast variants of these movements. But where did they come out of? When one thinks of the history of the left in this country, in the two waves of sort of left ascendancy in the 20th century, the 1930s, the 1960s, 70s, the ways that people organized and the kind of politics that they tended to have during those moments was quite different than and this sort of politics, which strangely enough, right now with the Occupy movement, people seem to think has just come out of nowhere. And yet, of course, as we will be discussing and are discussing, has actually quite a long history going back decades. But how do we understand these movements, which were based on nonviolence, based on consensus politics, based on a notion of prefigurative politics of creating the new within the shell of the old? How do they relate to the more traditional left, and how did they come about?
Well, you could think of these movements as having been formed by the younger brothers and sisters of the people who were involved in the movements of the 60s, particularly the late 60s. And these were younger brothers and sisters who were a bit critical of what their older siblings had been doing. Some of them had actually been involved in the movements of the 60s, and had essentially fled the focus on violence, or at least violent rhetoric, of the late 60s and early 70s. Some of them had moved to the countryside, formed communes in the countryside. There was a streak of the movements in the 1960s that I would say was implicitly anarchist, that didn't usually didn't use that term, but in fact was drawn to prefigurative politics, in other words, trying to form communities that prefigured the kind of society that we would like to have, and that were very much oriented towards the building of egalitarian communities. It was those people and younger people who looked at the sectarianism, the celebration of violence, the celebration of third world militancy, and said, we want to build something different. So I think that was essentially the center of the movement. Now, in some of these movements, and this was particularly true in the Livermore Action Group, there were also broader circles of people who were involved. There were religious people who became involved. there were people of older generations who became involved. The part of what was useful about the stance of nonviolence was that it made it possible for people to be involved in the movement who were older than their 20s.
What was the relationship of these movements to the counterculture?
I would say that they were, these movements sat at the intersection between the counterculture and what we thought of as the political left in the 60s. In the 1960s, there was a pretty sharp divide between the counterculture and the political left. It was a little bit fuzzier in the Bay Area than it was elsewhere, but generally speaking, you were on one side or the other. And what was interesting about these movements was that the people at the center of them were firmly on the left, but also very much influenced by the counterculture. That was particularly true, I would say, of many of the women. Women and a sort of anarchist version of feminism played a major role in these movements.
Well, let's talk about some of the specifics of the movements. In 1976 in New Hampshire, a movement was born in opposition to plans to build a nuclear plant at the coastal town of Seabrook. And this was called the Clamshell Alliance. What were the origins of the Clamshell Alliance? Who made it up, and what kind of politics did they have?
I would say that there were three groups, if you could call them that, that came together to build the Clamshell Alliance. One was people who had moved from the, who had been involved in the movements of the 60s, had moved from the cities to the countryside. There was a collective called the Montague Farm that was very much involved in building the Clamshell Alliance. Secondly, there were older members of the older Quakers, members of the AFSC, who...
That's the American Friends
Service
Committee.
Who moved to the coast so as to be involved in this, and who played an important role and brought the conceptions of nonviolence and consensus decision-making to the Clamshell. And then there were the people who simply lived in the towns that surrounded the area, surrounded Seabrook, and who had been upset about the possibility of a nuclear plant being built in their neighborhood. Ultimately, there was a fourth contingent, and that was, as the movement spread, people in Boston organized to contribute to it and began to play a major role.
And what was the scope, ultimately, of this movement, which ultimately was not successful in preventing the plant from being built, but in fact brought thousands of people together in opposition to it?
Right. Well, there were two occupations of the site. One of them was, they were very carefully staged. The first one involved only local people. I think there were 18 of them. They were all arrested, of course. The second one involved 180 people. The organizers talked about the power of 10. And that involved people from other areas as well. Then there were plans. Then there was a much larger one. The much larger one, I think, involved something like 2,400 people. If I remember correctly, about 1,400 of them remained to be arrested. And they were taken off to two large armories where they spent a couple of weeks. And this gave wonderful publicity to the anti-nuclear movement. So then the next question was, it was clear that there was real mass involvement and mass support for this effort. And the question was how to push it further. The issue became that the authorities had caught on to what was going on. And it was clear that if even larger numbers of people were to try to occupy the site, they would find that the gate was locked. This set off a debate within the movement about the issue of violence and nonviolence, with a group of people in Boston called the Hard Rain Collective.
And violence here being defined as property destruction?
Well, yes, except that it's a little more complicated than that, because the Hard Rain Collective, which was arguing for cutting the fences, said, well, You know, that's the only way that we can get into the site. And besides, any serious movement needs to take on the police. The people who were opposed to that were not necessarily against destruction of property, but they pointed out that if the fences were to be cut, it was obvious that the police would then attack the protesters. And they said that the knowledge that there was going to be violence at the demonstration would severely cut down on the numbers of people willing to participate outside of the principled issues involved of leading people into a situation where they would confront violence. So the issue was really not violence against property as a form of violence. It was the question of a kind of violence that was designed to provoke the police and that would lead to violence against protesters.
The movement of the Clamshell Alliance and the events in opposing this nuclear power plant in Seabrook led to real fractures within this model of creating this community which would prefigure a future society. And you're starting to explain how that came to pass, a real division that fractured the movement around a strategic question. What were the consequences of that?
Well, there was a very bitter split in the movement. Essentially, it led to the end of the Clamshell Alliance. What happened was that there were heated and bitter debates about the question of fence cutting and of what nonviolence consisted of, what violence consisted of. Ultimately, what happened was that the governor made a proposal to the steering committee that a demonstration be held at the site and that the Clamshell agree that everyone would leave after a certain point. The leadership of the Clamshell Alliance then disregarded consensus. And
when you say the leadership, isn't this a movement that wasn't supposed to have
leaders?
Yes,
ostensibly this was a movement without leadership. Everybody knew that, in fact, there was leadership. And this, by the way, was there were many people in the movement, even in Boston, who were uneasy about the proposal for cutting fences, but on the other hand, didn't like the fact that there was a leadership and saw the Hard Rain Collective and the people who advocating fence cutting as being marginalized, their voices were not being heard, and supported them out of a desire to include them rather than out of a genuine support for their politics.
And when you say the actual leadership, are you talking about people who were not officially leaders but ended up playing a role of leadership?
Well, I'm talking about the people who had founded the Clamshell, most of whom lived on the seacoast, had been involved in running around the country trying to form a national movement, and also had been identified by the press as good speakers, charismatic people, and so forth, and were essentially the unofficial leadership of the movement. And these were the people who were on the steering committee. The other problem was that those people and the people who lived on the coast had always thought that this struggle was essentially their struggle and that the people in Boston were supporting their struggle. The people in Boston thought that this was their struggle. So the organization and the relationship of different groups had not been worked out. So what happened was that the steering committee responded to the governor's proposal. They agreed to it. They agreed to it without consulting the people in Boston, so they broke consensus. The result of this was extremely bitter feelings within the organization. That demonstration was held, but the result of this was that the Clamshell Alliance ceased to exist, and bitter feelings persisted for a very long time.
So while the Clamshell Alliance was not successful in blocking this plant, and as you say, ultimately fell apart based on this bitter conflict, they were successful in galvanizing and bringing into this movement many, many people who had come through the Clamshell Alliance and absorbed the kind of politics that they had been espousing, organizational politics. And that was then disseminated all over the country on the larger scale here in Northern California and Central California in the opposition to the Diablo Canyon nuclear plant near San Luis Obispo. Tell us about the formation of the sister Abalone Alliance on the West Coast.
The Abalone Alliance was also formed out of a kind of coalition between people who lived in and around San Luis Obispo, particularly a group called Mothers for Peace, who were very much opposed to the Diablo plant going online. And people with the kinds of politics we've been talking about who came together to support them and to be involved in that struggle. And maybe partly because of the experience of the clamshell, people who were involved in the Abalone Alliance were able to avoid some of the tensions that had emerged in the clamshell. All of the people who were centrally involved either already lived in the San Luis Obispo area, or many people actually moved there in order to be involved in it. And this was where the sort of countercultural influence came in, because it was young people drawn to anarchist politics, or anarcho-feminist politics, as many of them called it, who had the freedom to be able to leave school, take time off from school, whatever, and become part of this struggle. And so and there were people from the rest of the state and elsewhere who were willing to come for mass actions. The result, and I would say that the Abalone Alliance, that in the Abalone Alliance, the commitment to nonviolence was more explicit and clearer than it had been in the clamshell, thus avoiding the kinds of problems the clamshell had had. And the influence of anarchism and anarcho-feminism was also probably more explicit.
And what do you mean by anarcho-feminism?
What I mean is groups mostly of women, though there were men who identified themselves as anarcho-feminists, who regarded building affinity groups and building egalitarian relations within those affinity groups and then within the movement as a whole as an expression of feminist politics. And who were also in many cases drawn to spirituality of various kinds. And my impression is that this kind of politics or sensibility was already quite widespread on the West Coast. And so it wasn't a matter of people learning this politics from within the Abalone Alliance, but rather that they brought this politics to it.
And what were the successes of the Abalone Alliance, and what sort of challenges did it face?
Well, the Abalone Alliance faced the challenge of, unlike Seabrook, where the plant had not yet been built, the Diablo plant already existed. And there really wasn't very much discussion about how it was going to be possible to force the dismantling of a plant that already existed. Ultimately, there was a very large occupation of the area around the plant. And in the course of that occupation, while people were being arrested, an engineer took a second look at the blueprints of the plant and discovered that there was a crucial error. And his announcement of that error actually came across the radio while people were being arrested. People felt that it was their victory, that he had been inspired by the demonstration to take a second look at the blueprints. The result of that was that the moment when the plant would go online was put way into the future.
So the movement against nuclear power ended up somewhat diminishing because nuclear power itself became, for economic reasons as well as political ones, much less viable. And of course, the meltdown of Three Mile Island in 1979 right. was a significant event in all of that. And so a number of groups or people who had been involved in the anti-nuclear power movement turned their attention to opposing nuclear weapons. And this, of course, was in the early years of Reagan's renewed Cold War bellicosity. And the Livermore Action Group was formed here in the Bay Area or in Northern California right. to oppose the University of California's nuclear weapons lab, Lawrence Livermore Lab. And you were a participant in that movement to oppose nuclear weapons. How did the Livermore Action Group, how was it formed, and to what degree did it build on the lessons of these two prior iterations of this movement?
Well, the Livermore Action Group was actually born in jail. Among people who had been arrested at Diablo in the men's jail, a list was passed around. Somebody decided to pass a list around getting names of those who would be interested in forming a movement to oppose the arms race and particularly the Livermore labs. And that was the nucleus of the Livermore Action Group. There were already peace groups in the Bay Area, but the Livermore Action Group quickly gained the leadership of, it gained the reputation for being the most radical and the most effective of the groups opposing the arms race. On the one hand, the Livermore Action Group inherited the ideology and the structure that had been developed by the Clamshell and by the Abalone Alliance. And what that meant was that it was taken for granted that it would be built around affinity groups, that it would use consensus process, and that it would be based on a commitment to nonviolence. All of this, by the way, was taken as feminist politics and anarchist politics. Anarchism was taken to imply women's equality, nonviolence, consensus, and the building of particular kinds of egalitarian communities. So all of that was inherited from this previous history. I would say that the negative side of it was that a disinclination for thinking about strategy was also inherited from the Clamshell and the Abalone. Now, the Clamshell and the Abalone had not talked about strategy, but there had been an implicit strategy. The implicit strategy was, we'll start by opposing nuclear power plants. We will close nuclear power plants down, and that will be the germ of a movement for a nonviolent revolution. And that was at least conceivable. Now, it didn't happen. They weren't able to close these plants down, but it was not out of the realm of possibility that that could have happened. The problem, I would say, for the Livermore Action Group was that its aims, its immediate aims, were more ambitious. The immediate aim was to end the arms race. The tactic for ending the arms race was civil disobedience actions. Now, if you think about that calmly, it's not going to work. One civil disobedience action is, first of all, not going to shut down the Livermore laboratory, because it'll start up the next day after everybody's arrested, and it certainly isn't going to shut down the whole arms race. But in a way, a kind of collective fantasy emerged in the Livermore Action Group that we would be able to end the arms race by engaging in these civil disobedience actions. So the connection between what we were doing and what we wanted to accomplish was never really thought about. I would say the other problem was that the focus of the movement became civil disobedience actions. Now, that had also been true in the Clamshell and the Abalone Alliance. It was interesting that the original leadership of the Clamshell had thought that civil disobedience actions were only one tactic and that other things should be pursued as well. But mass civil disobedience actions quickly became the focus of those two movements. And that was also true with the Livermore Action Group. That posed the question for the Livermore Action Group of, what do you do when you have held civil disobedience actions with essentially the largest number of people who are willing to get arrested in the Bay Area? Where do you go from there?
And ultimately, as movements do, the Livermore Action Group ebbed and flowed. But the impact of these movements actually has been quite remarkable. I think very presciently in Political Protest and Cultural Revolution, which you wrote over 20 years ago, you argued that this model of organizing And these sorts of politics would leave its imprint on the politics of the future. And we've seen that, I think, in a very pronounced way. I mean, certainly organizing around the shutdown of the World Trade Organization in Seattle was very much informed by it. And certainly one can think of people like David Solnit and key organizers in the shutdown of Seattle who had been part of these movements and influenced by them. The shutdown of San Francisco at the start of the U.S. invasion of Iraq, when direct action to stop the war shut the city down. And then, of course, in the Occupy movement, why do you think that these politics, this legacy of, let's say, the 60s, 70s, why this legacy has been particularly strong and these politics particularly influential to future generations of people, some of whom might have been, you know, young people involved in those movements in the 70s, but many of whom were actually had no connection to it whatsoever?
Well, speaking of the Livermore Action Group, though I think this applies a little bit more broadly, many of the people who became involved in the Livermore Action Group felt that they had no way of, that they had no voice. They had no way of making an impact on government policies that they felt directly threatened by. This was, after all, the period of the Second Cold War. People were very frightened about Reagan's escalation. And many people became involved in these politics, and I think this was true both of the young people and the older people, because they felt this was a way of breaking through the logjam. If their vote didn't count, they could vote with their bodies, essentially. And I think it was also attractive because it because of the prefigurative politics, because of the idea that you were building the kind of community that you wanted to see projected more broadly. I think that this kind of politics continues to have the same appeal, because since then we've had generations of young people who have very little confidence in having any impact through the electoral system, and who are very angry about what the United States is doing in the world. So I think that's the basis for it. When I finished this book, I wrote this book thinking that these movements would be the beginning of a new approach in left politics. When the movements that I was studying all collapsed, I thought, well, as usual, I was wrong. It now seems that to some degree I was right, but not entirely, because what has remained is the commitment to action outside the electoral sphere and to consensus process. What has not remained is the commitment to nonviolence. That has been dropped along the way, and in some cases actually has been explicitly rejected. And I think that shift came in Seattle in the 1999 protests. The same debates remain about violence and nonviolence. There's the same confusion about nonviolence automatically equaling pacifism and meaning absolutely no destruction of property, which is not what it ever meant. And I think there is still the same division, or two of the same divisions. One is the tendency in the Occupy movement to identify the tactic as the identity of the movement. And the second is the question of whether the aim of the movement is to build a mass movement, or whether it is to build militant action among those who are most identified with its aims.
Well, that question of strategy and the, let's just say, in some cases, allergy to strategic thinking certainly seems to be something that has colored the left over the last three decades. You write that in the movements, the nonviolent direct action movements in the 1970s and 80s, some of the Christian groups who played a very big role in the movement thought of strategic considerations as almost a type of blasphemy, that one should just bear witness and the rest was in God's hands. While that might be sort of an extreme form of anti-strategic thinking, the kind of critique that you make about these movements certainly is something that we could continue to see now. Why do you think the American left in recent decades at least, has such a problem with thinking strategically and often conflates tactics with strategy.
Mm-hmm. Let me start off with the Occupy movement and then see if I can answer your question more broadly. In the case of the Occupy movement, I don't think there's the same principled opposition to strategic thinking that there was among some of the religious groups in the nonviolent direct action movement. I think it's more that there is an enormous focus on maintaining the unity of the movement and a fear that if there's strategic discussion, there's going to be a disagreement. It's the same issue around demands. If the Occupy movement were to make any demands, some people would be lost. And the primary aim in many people's minds of the movement is to hold the movement together and not have these discussions. I think the mistake is these discussions are ultimately going to be held. And if a movement ceases to, if a movement loses its focus and its sense of momentum, it's going to lose people anyway. The divisions over strategy are not the only way of losing people. Actually, it's easier to lose people if the movement itself loses momentum. Second question, I think, is organization. One of the ways in which the current Occupy movement is different than the nonviolent direct action movement of the 80s is that the movement of the 80s had a very clear form of organization. It was different than the organization of the movements of the 60s, but it was nevertheless quite well defined. And it actually, in many cases, worked very smoothly. The Occupy movement has no national organization whatsoever. And even local organization is extremely fluid. It's very difficult to make decisions under those circumstances. And it's very difficult to even have strategic discussions. If you have no lines of communication, how can you have a strategic discussion? So I think the question of organization is very much part of this. I also think, though, that the left has been so weak for so long that nobody has any conception of, in a certain sense, you have to have a movement, or at least the potentiality of having a movement, before you can begin to envision how it can change society. So I think that the weakness of the left over the last, 30 years or so has virtually precluded strategic discussions, because those discussions cannot be about anything concrete. In the absence of organizations, how is it possible to imagine actually having a strategy for social change?
Well, one of the issues that comes up in these questions around how to organize and how to organize strategically is around, and perhaps this follows from the argument that you're making about the weakness of the left and these being in some ways symptoms of that weakness. But there's a huge emphasis on symbolic action and bearing witness, mm-hmm. which tends to not, I mean, it can fit in with uh-huh. a strategy, but often is a substitute for strategy. Uh-huh. We will bear witness or we will do something. And what that has led to often over, you know, many years has been about politics as a media spectacle, but not really politics about either figuring out how to have an impact, a real material or impact on whatever your target is, and at the same time isn't necessarily about building a mass movement. I mean, people think that they may be galvanizing support through the media, but it's not really a way of actively reaching out to people.
I would even take that a notch further and say that the problem is not even so much symbolic action. Symbolic action can be a useful way of sending a message to people who might support and become involved with a movement. It's often an emphasis actually on expressive action, meaning you go out in the streets and you express your feelings, which can mean expressing your anger. And you don't think about whether that expression, what the results of that expression of anger will be, how that will be read by constituencies who might otherwise be supportive of what you're doing. In a way, a focus on expressive politics is ipso facto anti-strategic because it involves simply thinking about how to express how you feel rather than thinking about the effects of your action.
Well, what about the brittleness of movements that have been organized this way? There's been a lot of focus on the kind of consensus-based politics of the Occupy movement, which obviously has deep roots, as we've been exploring. And it has, for many people who've participated in the Occupy movement, often for the first time in politics, it's been an exciting process to be part of a very different way of making decisions mm-hmm. and being involved in politics and feeling some sort of collective sense from it. And in some sense, really, for a lot of people, it does feel prefigurative. It seems like it projects from the present into the future the kind of society that one might want to live in. But are there problems with that kind of model for movements that are sustained over time? One can see it functioning mm-hmm. quite well, perhaps, within movements that last for a couple months. But what about movements that have designs on making change over mm-hmm. a number of years?
Mm-hmm. I would say that on the one hand, there are real advantages to consensus politics. The consensus process can bring out the best in people. I have seen it in jail mobilize people who you wouldn't have thought could make a real contribution to the movement to make real contributions. And it's because it makes everyone feel not like just a follower, but, you know, actually an integral part of the movement. People feel that their voice really matters. So that's the advantage. I would say that consensus decision-making works as long as everyone wants it to work. That's the weakness. If you have a group that is more invested in having its approach adopted than it is in the survival of the movement, consensus decision-making will fall apart. That's what happened in the Clamshell Alliance. So that's problem number one. You can't have severe disagreements within the movement. Consensus politics will fall apart. Second problem is it works very well for decisions that can be made over a period of time. If a rapid decision is necessary, consensus doesn't work. That's also what happened in the Clamshell Alliance. Third problem is that because consensus decision-making can be such a cumbersome process, it favors people who have a lot of time. That usually means young people. Older people, people with jobs, people with families, and so forth, often simply can't stay around for the process. I would say that the final disadvantage of consensus process is that it's too easy for people to block decisions by the group as a whole, and therefore it can actually become undemocratic because a small group of people can manipulate the process so as to keep things from happening that they don't want to happen.
Well, how about this question of leaderlessness, which was a central value of the nonviolent direct action movements in the 1970s and 80s, and is one that is also championed by the Occupy mm-hmm. movement. To what degree are the kinds of issues that you mentioned, say, within the Clamshell Alliance, where informal leaders end up having a great deal of power, how much are those sorts of problems perennial ones within this model?
I would say that those have been perennial problems. The problem is that positive side of this is that there's a critique of old models of leadership in which some people order other people around, basically.
And the left has had a lot of that.
But the question is, how do you go about changing that? Is it a matter of rejecting leadership altogether, or is it a matter of trying to devise new forms of leadership? Because the fact of the matter is that any movement that functions has leadership, whether it's acknowledged or it isn't acknowledged. There have got to be people who are spending more time than other people and who are figuring out what the questions are, what the path ahead is, and so forth. And there are two problems with a lack of recognition of that leadership. The first is that they are, by definition, unaccountable. if everyone is denying that they are leaders, then they're not going to be accountable. All right, saying that everybody is a leader. The second problem is, even if you have people who understand that they are actually informal leadership and therefore they have to be accountable and, you know, therefore there have to be lines of communication that make that possible, if you don't recognize the existence of leadership, you don't have the ability to develop a new layer of leadership. And that means that when the first layer of leadership gets burned out, which they do inevitably, the organization falls apart because other people are not prepared to step into their shoes.
What about this question of conflict? All movements, to greater and lesser degrees, have conflicts. There are going to be different visions, even when people share a lot of the same ideas and even strategies. And in the nonviolent direct action movements of the 70s and 80s, you suggest that a lack of willingness to recognize that conflict is going to be a part of politics, that it is a healthy part of mm-hmm. politics, and that that should be dealt with in some sort of frontal way, ended up being a problem for these movements. Given the whole sectarian history of the left, you can see why people might mm-hmm. want to shy away from conflict or avoid conflict. But why do you think it's really so important to actually deal with conflict head on and build in structures that allow movements to deal mm-hmm. with conflict?
Well, because as movements develop, they have to face new challenges. And there are inevitably going to be different opinions about how to face those challenges. It would be a bad thing if there weren't different opinions, because it's like the question of strategy. You have to talk about strategy, and you have to consider various options. And some people in groups are going to favor some options, and some are going to favor other options. And so you have to actually promote those discussions rather than trying to squelch them. And I think it's a little bit like the critique of leadership. It went too far. The critique of leadership turned into an opposition to leadership in toto, when it should have been a critique of certain styles of leadership. Same is true about debates within movements. It should be a critique of the kinds of polemical debates that went on in the old left and also in the late 60s, rather than a rejection of debates as a whole. And what that turned into was making the unity within the movement and the building of community within the movement the main priority. Once you make, if a community is built in the process of struggle, and then struggle, the direction of the movement ceases to be the main aim, and sustaining the community becomes the main aim, the community is going to fall apart because it no longer has a basis.
Well, lastly, let me ask you, what are the lessons that you particularly think that the Occupy movement should draw from these precursor movements, let's say, mm-hmm. that have many of the characteristics of the Occupy movement, and you've signaled a lot of the same strengths and weaknesses? What most pressingly do you think mm-hmm. should be drawn from those movements by the Occupy movement?
I guess there's a positive lesson and there's a negative lesson. The positive lesson is, I think the Occupy movement should think about forms of organization. I actually think it's become more difficult to organize movements than it used to be, because society is more atomized than it used to be. But I think that the forms of organization of the direct action movement should be looked at, not necessarily to be copied directly, but with an understanding that if you don't have organization of some sort, it makes your movement extremely volatile and episodic, and very vulnerable to disappearing in a rapid period of time. And I also think, that the commitment to nonviolence should be looked at, because I think that the argument that was made by many people in this movement, that in the United States, a commitment to nonviolence is necessary if you're going to form a mass movement, still holds. Now, much of the Occupy movement actually believes that, but there are parts of the Occupy movement that don't. The negative lesson, I think, is the failure of the nonviolent direct action movement to look at the question of strategy. What was the relationship between the tactics they were using and their long-term goals, and how could they bring those two into closer alignment? I think that had a lot to do with the fragility of these movements, and I think that the Occupy movement should look at that and try not to make the same mistake.
My guest has been social movement scholar Barbara Epstein. She is chair of the History of Consciousness Department at UC Santa Cruz, and she wrote 20 years ago the very prescient book, Political Protest and Cultural Revolution, Nonviolent Direct Action in the 1970s and 80s, and that is still available from the University of California Press.
I think Barbara Epstein's conclusion that there has to be leaders, there's always leaders, is failing to note the role of the internet in coordinating what happens. Computers, of course, much better at counting votes and doing other algorithmic processes, especially if they're open source and people trust that, rather than the black box voting scams that we've looked at other occasions on the show. Now, as Chris Hedges says, it might change its form, but I don't think Occupy is likely to lose much momentum. Because what else are people going to do? Consumer capitalism is no longer offering people houses to live in, never mind increasing products to consume, and living together, the super low resource usage Bangladeshi style approach, isn't necessarily a hardship, it's a question of attitude. Recalling also Marshall Rosenberg's ideas that you don't punish people, you don't reward them, so you're not trying to motivate them through external manipulation. And he said, if you ever do that, everybody pays. Ironic that he should use a financial metaphor. What he's saying is, there are problems of not trusting in innate human generosity. Whilst that is countercultural to economics, criminology, and a lot of other disciplines, I think people's everyday experience, unexpected though it may be, in Occupy's living together is directly counteracting the culture of atomization. I think atomization, as Charles Eisenstein suggests, has reached its apogee. People are now coming together, and one of the last big barriers that is keeping people apart is the money system, the fact that it is personal, and the more you get off somebody else, the more you have and the less they have. It's a direct win-loss situation. I think much more appropriate to the Occupy is a direct gift economy. Now, they don't need any kind of electronic mediation for the local community within an Occupy, but between Occupies and for coordinating. Now, this, I think, is one of the key elements that missed out by Barbara Epstein, because she's thinking in the 1970s and 1980s in the older technologies. I hope gift economy software developers will be inspired by Marshall Rosenberg to encourage people to state their needs and to state their feelings. A means of joint communication, something which actually merges social, if you like, blogging with economic, a statement of needs, a statement of appreciation for people, with the political, decision-making, organizing direct action, something that does so through decentralized software, which puts nobody in charge, capital C, but puts everybody in charge, small c, because just by stating your opinions, then you are contributing. So nobody has power, but everybody has influence. If you'd like to download this show or any of our previous shows, you can do so at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. Our theme music is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thanks for listening. If you've got an Occupy near you, I'd encourage you to nip over, see if there's anything you can help them with.
To help these poor workers.